Well, good afternoon, everyone. This is Scott Stevens joining you for the Jesus Factor here on the Eagle Radio Network. We hope you'll stick around. We've got a program on John Smith, Pocahontas, that is, on the Virginia colony, and the news of the day. Stay tuned for that. Well, good afternoon. Once again, this is Scott Stevens here on the Jesus Factor. And it seems that I may be having some issues with the audio from my musical side of the program. I apologize for that. My hope is that I can get that straightened out. It seems that my audio from the mic is all right, and I'll wait for some feedback on the chat to find out about that. Some good programming here today on the network, and for me, over this last week, the sense of how far we can be from getting things right in the Lord while thinking that we in fact have it right, thinking that we are sufficient. That place of humility that the visitation of the Lord upon us over this past week of services has brought for me, anyway, I don't know about the rest of you, but has given me a sense that I really need to seek Him in earnest. And for me, I mean, look, a lot of that is done in the prayer closet, in meditation, in time alone, in seeking Him and being focused on Him and retaining that focus as I move forward through my day, determined no matter how I feel that He, in accordance with His promise and the power of His resurrection, is with me. To me, that's not natural. I know to most people it isn't. He doesn't want to leave us in that place, destitute in recognition of our sin, and not lift us up out of that. But it is our focus on Him and our decision to be in that place of focus that makes that happen for us. And it is through that that we lay claim to the promises of God by faith. This week has been an interesting one in the news. We have a number of things going on politically. Of course, the election coming up shortly here in the United States. And we talk on a regular basis here on the Jesus Factor about Israel and the events going on in the Middle East. There are a number of things. Of course, in the background, we have Iran marching toward the capacity to deliver nuclear weapons further and wider as time goes on. And that certainly seems to be something that folks ought to be paying attention to. And Mitt Romney, of course, one of the presidential candidates, was over there. And he has made a statement of late. And that statement was recorded in the in the Washington Post, among other places. The Israeli newspaper, in fact, Haaretz, said that Mitt Romney, this is today on Meet the Press, and it was reported in Israel this week, said that he respects the right of Israel to defend itself, but backed off an earlier foreign policy advisor's suggestion that he would support a unilateral military strike by Israel against Iran to stop Tehran from obtaining nuclear weapon capacity. The presumptive Republican nominee began a series of meetings with top Israeli officials here Sunday and plans to deliver a muscular defense of Israel in a formal speech delivered near Jerusalem's Old City. When he was asked on an interview with CBS's Face the Nation whether he would support Israel's bombing of Iran, Romney responded, "That would be a statement which would be of a different nature than what our nation has already expressed with regard to Iran." Isn't that the truth? I mean, quite clearly, our present policy is one of delaying and allowing Iran, in spite of our best efforts at negotiation, because we are clearly not willing to stand militarily. Now, that being said, there has been a huge military buildup out in the Middle East, bigger than any in history in that area. It's been done quietly here in from the United States, and our military authorities here have begun to position naval forces for air support there, should they be necessary. But there is no clear declaration of policy, either from President Obama or from the Republican candidate. What we have here is more double-mindedness, halting between two opinions. Will we or will we not support the only real ally that we have in the Middle East in the event they should choose to go into Iran and stop the ongoing production of nuclear material in that country? Nothing the United Nations has done, or no negotiation that we have entered in, has produced any fruit in these matters. And combined with the military alliances in Syria with Russia and China, and the Arab nations as a whole, this all spells trouble if something is not done to defuse the situation. It seems to me that the longer Israel waits, the greater the difficulty of stopping Iran will be. And our own military sources, we reported here last week, have said that Iran's military capability is formidable. Formidable means one that is difficult to be reckoned with. Meanwhile, on the financial front, we have a number of quarterly reports coming out this week, and CEOs of a great number of businesses saying that the situation in Europe and the difficulty that various European economies are having, struggling to manage and pay down their debts, is a damper on the world economy and may be detrimental to that economy for the next 12 to 24 months. We've said on the Jesus Factor for some time that the housing crisis here in the United States was not the end but the beginning of the economic tribulation that is just around the corner. The situation in Europe is ugly, but imagine, if you will, what's going on in Greece and Spain, with people dependent on government sources for income not being able to get that income. Imagine that in the United States, where only 50% of the American public actually pays money into the federal government. Well, it looks like I've got a little audio difficulty with my musical side of the program, so we're going to try and carry things off, in spite of the fact that that's the case. And, of course, while all of this stuff is dealt with and tested beforehand, and sometimes during a program it can be maddening when something technical happens and you can't quite get it figured out what it is that might be causing it. And in the midst of that, I can tell you that it's kind of like flying an airplane, except you don't really die. Anybody who's ever been through it, I know my brother Paul and all the other brothers that I have out there and sisters that are on programs here on the network have had this experience, and it is not a comfortable one. So I apologize to my listeners for that. We had some things put together for you here that we hope would be a blessing to you. And in spite of the fact that that musical side, which I know a number of people out there enjoy, looks like it's going to be on hold for today's show, we'll go forward with what we have for you out of the pages of history. And here in the Jesus Factor last week, we spoke at length about the organization of businesses and voyages before businesses that set out from Europe to the New World, largely from Britain. And we spoke at length about Virginia last week, and we made mention of John Smith, and we said, of course, that we would have a program here today for you on John Smith and some of the key players that were present at that particular time. And, of course, John Smith was a guy who began in Britain and has an extensive military history. He was born at Willoughby, Lincolnshire, about 150 miles north of London in eastern England, and was baptized on January 9th, 1580. He was the son of a yeoman farmer, and Smith spent his childhood just a few miles from the sea, which may have helped inspire his desire for adventure. He received a basic education in area schools, and then his father apprenticed him to a merchant in King's Lynn, a port town about 30 miles southeast of Willoughby. After Smith's father died in 1596, the 16-year-old youth abandoned his apprenticeship and began soldiering in the Netherlands. Thus began a military career that took him to France, Scotland, Italy, Greece, the Balkans, Austria, Poland, and Germany, among many other places. He learned horsemanship during a brief interlude at home and then participated in a war between the Hungarians and the Turks. Smith was captured by the latter and sent to Constantinople and the Caucasus. Some will remember Jesus Factor broadcast covering the empire called the Ottoman Empire over in that area at that time. That part of the world was dominated by followers of Islam, and there was ongoing conflict between them and their bordering countries for over a century. And Smith was, as an Englishman, part of that conflict on the side of these various European countries. Although he was then only 29 years of age, Smith had acquired vast renown and experience by military exploits, and his fame filled his companions with envy. He had been a wild, rollicking lad whose friends gave him 10 shillings and said to get rid of him. And he went to France as a servant to an English nobleman. He was soon dismissed by his new master and then engaged in the wars in the Low Countries. And at the end of a long campaign, when he was 19 years of age, he returned to England, but himself built himself a hut in a dark forest and became a hermit, and devoted much of his time to the study of military history and tactics and the practicing of horsemanship. The hermit became the theme of many a wild tale when he suddenly disappeared. Rudolf, Emperor of Germany, was then waging war against the Turks, who were pressing westward through Hungary. And this again is the conflict that we spoke of at length as we went through the history of the Ottoman Empire some time ago on the Jesus Factor. Those European countries had been in conflict from time to time, border wars, with the Ottoman Empire, which had expanded all over the Middle East. We won't go through all of its limits here today, but it was a dominant political and economic force in that region for well over 100 years. In fact, I think it was might have been as much as 300 years through the various successions of sultanates. But that broadcast is out there if people are interested in learning more about it. Smith resolved to join the Christian army against the Turks. After various vicissitudes, he reached Marseille, where he embarked for Italy in a ship filled with Roman Catholic pilgrims. A terrible storm arose, and the superstitious pilgrims believed the howling tempest to be a token of God's anger because they were voyaging with a heretic. Of course, Smith was not a Catholic. He had become a Christian as a youth under practices perhaps somewhat dubious according to Scripture, but believed the gospel And while the King James Bible was not yet in circulation, much of the translation into English had been circulated in the form of tracts in England. So there was increasing knowledge and faith in the gospel of Jesus Christ throughout Britain. And as time goes on, we will see that for Smith, that faith was an ever-growing one. So, like they did with the prophet, they cast him overboard. You will remember from the word that the prophet was cast overboard when he was on the ship. They thought he would be a curse to them. And he swam to an island not far off, from which he was taken in a French vessel to Alexandria. Afterward, on a voyage in the Levant. Now, the Levant, some people may remember from our discussions about the Ottoman Empire, the Levant is the area that makes up the broader Middle East with Israel in its center, where they fell in with a Venetian vessel richly laden and captured her. Soon after that, Smith joined the German army, then fighting the Turks in Transylvania, where his skill and prowess won for him great renown. On one occasion, while besieging a town, a famous leader of the Muslims challenged any Christian to single combat for the amusement of the ladies of the city. You'll remember, of course, when the Philistines offered this opportunity to Israel. Interesting parallel. When David slew the Philistine Goliath on the field of battle while others cowered. Smith was the chosen champion. The Turkish lord appeared in the arena outside the walls in a suit of glittering mail. On his shoulders were large wings made of eagle's feathers, garnished with gold and precious stones. Smith appeared in a plain suit of steel. Both were on horseback, and their weapons were the lances of the old knights. From the walls, covered with ladies and soldiers, and from the Christian camp went up loud shouts as the combatants approached each other. And the tilt was fierce. By skillful movement, Smith thrust his spear point into the helmet of his antagonist and pierced his brain. The Turk fell dead when his head was cut off and sent to the Christian camp. Two other champions who fought Smith to avenge the death of their leader shared the same fate. So Smith, this actually becomes a centerpiece of his, of the essentially a legend that began to develop around him for his military prowess. And some will remember George Washington. The interesting parallel between Smith in all of this and Washington is that there are testimonies of people on the battlefield that say that George Washington was a giant, that he couldn't be killed by gunfire. He would ride his very large horse out into the midst of battle in a place where he was at the greatest risk, more than the soldiers that served under him. And yet he survived all of that conflict. We find people throughout history who believe God and believe that God has a purpose for them in acts of valor like this, though they are no different from you or I. Later on, Smith was made a prisoner and sold to Paca, who sent him to Constantinople as a slave for his mistress, whom that officer wished to marry. The gallant Christian, then in the bloom of young manhood, won the heart of the Turkish maiden, to whom, like the Moor, he told the story of his adventures. She tried to release him by sending him to her brother in the Crimea, but he there experienced the most grinding slavery. Now this is typical of the testimony that we hear of people that have gone by in history. Their trials are astounding
in comparison with what little hardship many of us endure today. But who cries the louder? I know in my case, it doesn't take a lot of hardship or being put into slavery. Those kinds of things would shake me up pretty good. But he remained faithful and stood. At length he escaped in the garb of his master, whom he slew in anger. And after many stirring adventures on the continent, he returned to England in 1604. You will remember that the Virginia colony was essentially established just a couple of years later. His military prowess earned him the rank of captain and the title of gentleman. And his experience sharpened his ambition and thirst for further adventure. Smith soon joined a new enterprise. This is the one that we spoke of at some length on the program last week. The businesses that were established to hopefully successfully colonize the New World. Bartholomew Gosnold and others secured a charter on April 10th of 1606 that established these two companies to explore and colonize the coast of North America. One, based in Plymouth, had a present-day New England as its objective. The other, in London, looked to the Chesapeake Bay area. It was called the Council of Virginia. And the Council of Virginia was composed of investors, all right, and all of these investors had assets they put into both of these companies, and they oversaw their various activities and voyages. Now, as we look forward here, they were established, these two groups that were essentially businesses looking to be profitable, were established after the first earlier effort of colonization here, known as the Lost or Roanoke Colony. Some listeners might remember that this group of colonists were left in America, and after several failed voyages to return to the colony for resupply from England, they were never found again. As I said in last week's broadcast, there were many, and this was all under the guidance of Sir Walter Raleigh at the time, there were many at that time that would have turned in Britain from the continuing effort to colonize the New World. It was obviously a dangerous and difficult endeavor, one that required a person to give up everything on one side of an ocean in hope of finding something better on the other side. Some of the investors in the Council of Virginia and their supporters had earlier been involved in the Carolina colonization effort. Smith joined the investors in the company bound for the Chesapeake, and on December 20th, 1606, the three ships of the expedition set sail. With them went a box not to be opened until the vessels arrived in Virginia, containing a list of the men who would govern the group there. We mentioned this last week, but the details of it are fascinating. Smith, it seems, had a way of abrading certain people. Often, according to my read of the history, these were people that were somewhat prideful and thought highly of their own roles and opinions in situations. Smith was the kind of a guy that was a get-things-done guy. And while it seems that he had a level of pride and arrogance in some of these matters himself, he actually could get things done. And some of those that were in authority over the ship staged a series of events, or essentially engineered them, to appear that Smith was at fault. Between about a third and a half of the group that was on this initial voyage were considered gentlemen, and the gentry included former soldiers and privateers. The rest of the party were seamen, laborers, and boys, except for a dozen craftsmen and artisans, including a tailor, a surgeon, a blacksmith, a mason, two bricklayers, four carpenters, and two barbers. Most of the first planters hoped to find wealth and return home to England in a year or two. They were not interested in settling in Virginia permanently or in farming. as they expected to be supplied with food and other necessities during their sojourn and then leave. The voyage to America began badly and got worse, especially for Smith. First, contrary and stormy weather just off the English coast delayed the small fleet for 6 weeks, and many on board became seasick. Next, close quarters, illness, and boredom inflamed the landsmen, who became fractious. They fought amongst one another, argued. Finally, on February 13th of 1607, Smith was arrested for mutiny and confined. The undertaking seemed to be falling apart, although it had scarcely begun. Smith had run afoul of several of the company's principal leaders, most of whom were his social betters, as well as his elders. Christopher Newport, an experienced seafarer who was around 41, commanded the fleet for the duration of the voyage. Edward Maria Wingfield, a soldier from a noble family who became the colony's first president, was about 56. Bartholomew Gosnold, a founder of the company, was 34, and he captained one of the ships. Newport and Wingfield especially disliked Smith, considering him an upstart and a social climber. Smith probably irritated them beyond endurance by questioning their decisions and offering unsolicited advice, and as well by merely being young, ambitious, and contentious. He was full of himself. Gosnold eventually intervened and got Smith out from under arrest when the ships arrived in Virginia. After the first landing and fight with the local inhabitants on April 26th, Newport opened the box and read the list of councilmen. Newport, Wingfield, Gosnold, John Ratcliffe, Captain John Martin, Captain George Kendall, and last, Captain John Smith. Probably, at the instigation of Newport and Wingfield, the council refused to allow Smith to take his seat. On April 29th, the company held a ceremony, including a cross-raising at the landing site, which Newport named Cape Henry, and took formal possession of the country for King James and the Protestant faith. Of course, this was a period of time during the kingship of James I, who gave us the King James Bible in 1611. And many in this period had left Britain, perhaps many on this voyage. We know on the Plymouth voyages, there were many who left in hope of coming to a new place where they could serve God in accordance with their conscience rather than under the authority of the Church of England, whose head, of course, was the King of England. To many of the early reformers who had begun to get a hand on the Word of God in various forms before ultimately the publication of the King James, to many of them it seemed unlikely that there would be a worldly king as head of the church. Many of them also saw that the ceremonies of the Anglican tradition smacked largely of that which had gone on in Catholicism, which the reformers throughout Europe had called idolatry. So when they took Cape Henry and took possession for King James and the Protestant faith, the reverend who was on board, there was a minister named Robert Hunt who was their chaplain, and he preached a sermon and invoked the blessings of God upon their undertaking. It was a beautiful May and spring, warm and sunny, as in England in that season. The air was filled with the smell of wild flowers, and the children of the forest, friendly and kind, were looking on in wonder. The sound of the metal axe was first heard then in Virginia. The first tree was felled, and the first foundation was laid for a dwelling on that spot where the first permanent English settlement in America was planted. The newcomers then set off to explore the James River and find a location for their settlement. For the next 2 weeks, the colonists discovered up and down the river, past the mouth of the Chickahominy River to the Appomattox River. Along the way, they encountered several Powhatan tribes, most of whom were friendly and hospitable, feasting and entertaining the newcomers. The Englishmen were impressed by the towns they visited, as well as the cornfields they saw. They considered a point of land called Archer's Hope for their settlement, but when they could not anchor near the shore, they selected instead the peninsula they called Jamestown Island. There, the water near the shore was deep enough that the ships could be tied to trees on the bank. On May 13th, the Englishmen arrived, and the next day, they began to establish their settlement. The place they had selected lay on the eastern edge of Paspahana territory. A week later, Newport decided that sufficient progress had been made that he would follow Virginia Council's instructions to explore upriver in hopes of finding a way to the Western Sea, which at that point was believed to lie just beyond a Great Lake mountain. For the next few days, he led a party of 23 men, including Smith, up the James River to the falls just above the town of Powhatan. Again, the group was greeted by seemingly friendly inhabitants, eager to trade. Disappointed that the falls impeded further navigation, Newport led the explorers back to Jamestown, where he learned that some Powhatan warriors had attacked the settlement and killed two Englishmen. He ordered a proper fort constructed, and soon a triangular stockaded structure was erected with two bastions facing up and downstream to guard against attacks by the Spanish, and a third facing inland to confront the Powhatan. Now, all of this is important because what's going on here is as the English make further and further inroads into the native territory, their encounters with them, while at times friendly, clearly become more dangerous. And Smith's role in all of this is about to emerge as one that is critical to the ultimate success of the colonization and growth here in the New World. The English installed a cannon on each bastion of their fort, and Newport departed then for England on June 22nd, taking the Susan Constant and Godspeed. We mentioned these two ships leaving for England last week, leaving Wingfield in charge. Soon thereafter, conditions at Jamestown deteriorated, and men began to die of various diseases brought on by bad weather and sanitation, most likely salt poisoning, typhoid, and dysentery. We spoke at some length last week of this period. It was a period of great trial for the colonists, during which the Lord would move through Smith in behalf of the colonists. It is clear that the course they were on would have led to each and every one of them dying. There was a point in the midst of this, we spoke of last week, where a person was dying every day. Imagine a small settlement surrounded by natives who may or may not like you too well, Spanish who are seeking to take the colony out from under you, and being so sick that everyone as a group is so sick that one person in this group of people is dying each day. Imagine what it takes to continue to hope sometime, somehow, that things will turn around. Gosnold was the most experienced and respected leader in the colony, and he was among the dead. On September 10th, Ratcliffe, Smith, and Martin deposed Wingfield and then tried him on various charges, including atheism. So Wingfield, who had been installed as governor, is now removed based on these charges. Wingfield returned to England in the next year and then protested vehemently, but the Virginia Company hushed up the matter to avoid frightening away investors. Ratcliffe became president, but the colonists fared no better until Smith, at least by his own account and everything that we can gather from history points to this being true, began trading with the native people for food, sometimes at the point of a gun. Throughout the fall of the year, he and several companions went from one town to another in search of corn, frequently escorted by native guides. In November and in early December, Smith made several forays for corn on the Chickahominy River, and one day he and two other Englishmen, accompanied by two Powhatan Indians, rowed upstream to find the river's source. About 20 miles above the Chickahominy, the town of Apacunt, the party separated and Smith continued with one native guide. What's going on here? And this is where Smith's operation begins to be important. It's what many of us in elementary school were taught about all of this. Though the part about the Christianity of the people that are involved in it, at least according to my recollection of my public school education, was left out. They were called heroes, and they were called good people, and they were lifted up as being wonderful in the history of the country. But the fact that the people that are about to come together and play a critical role in the preservation and ongoing growth of the New World are quite clearly believers on the Lord Jesus Christ. So Smith and this other one guide goes up and they begin exploring further up, and suddenly 200 men surround him and they capture him after a struggle and brought him before Opechancanough. Smith's companions had all been killed, only he was left alive. And after impressing his captors with his compass, apparently they found that interesting, Smith was then marched from one town to another and displayed to the people before being presented to Powhatan at Werowocomoco. That's a tough word. There, according to Smith's famous writing published in 1624, he was about to be executed when Pocahontas, Powhatan's daughter, intervened to save him. And he was thereafter adopted as one of the native peoples. In 1616, this is many years later, but it's representative of an account that Smith gave. Smith wrote a letter to Queen Anne in anticipation of Pocahontas' visit to England, which we're going to talk about at length here in a bit. In this account, his capture included the threat of his own death. At any minute of my execution, at the minute of my execution, he wrote, she, meaning Pocahontas, hazarded the beating out of her own brains to save mine. And not only that, but so prevailed with her father that I was then safely conducted to Jamestown. Pocahontas' story is an important one, not only because she was a help to the colony, but because history tells us that she was the first Native American to become a Christian in the New World. According to Smith, Pocahontas was, and this is a quote, was the most dear and well-beloved daughter of Powhatan, the powerful chief of the Algonquin Indians in the Tidewater region of Virginia. She was born around 1595 to one of Powhatan's many wives. They named her Matawaka, though she was better known by us, of course, as Pocahontas. Pocahontas means, by the way, little wanton, a playful, frolicsome little girl. It's thought that Pocahontas probably saw white men for the first time in May of 1607, when Englishmen landed at Jamestown. The one she found most likable was Captain John Smith. Pocahontas' first meeting with Smith during his captivity is thought by many historians to have been a mock execution and salvation ceremony that was traditional with the Indians. And according to Smith, of course, Pocahontas' actions were probably one part of that ritual, whether he saw it as such or not. And I can tell you that my experience in doing research for this broadcast is there is some disagreement as to whether or not how the Indians, the natives at this point, perceived all that was going on here. Some historians don't give any credibility at all to the idea that this was just a Native American ceremony. And those that are unbelievers and atheists give no credibility at all to some of the testimony of John Smith. Go figure. There's that division that we find over and over again throughout history when the Spirit of God is working in situations to bring things about for the sake of people that he's seeking to call and to bless. At any rate, Pocahontas and Smith soon became friends. Relations with the Indians continued to be generally friendly for the next year, and Pocahontas was a frequent visitor to Jamestown. She delivered messages from her father and accompanied Indians bringing food and furs to trade for hatchets and trinkets. She was a lively young girl, and when young boys of the colony turned cartwheels, she would follow and wheel around herself in the same way that the young boys did. She apparently admired John Smith very much and would also chat with him during her visits. Her lively character and poise made her appearance striking. Several years after their first meeting, Smith described her as a child of 10 years old, which not only for feature, countenance, and proportion, much exceedeth any of the rest of his, that is, Powhatan's people, but for wit and spirit, the own nonpareil of his country. One that stood above, stood out among the others, according to John Smith's testimony. One that was obviously somehow different than many of the others here. Pocahontas apparently married an Indian, in accordance with their traditions, named Cocoam in 1610. She lived in Potomac country among Indians, but her relationship with the Englishman was not over. When an energetic and resourceful member of the Jamestown settlement, Captain Samuel Argyle, learned where she was, he devised a plan to kidnap her and hold her for ransom. This sounds like a good idea to do to somebody who's actually been helpful to you. With the help of Japazaw's lesser chief of the Potomac Indians, Argyle lured Pocahontas onto his ship. When told she would not be allowed to leave, she began to be exceeding pensive and discontented. That's a quote. But she eventually became calmer and even accustomed to her captivity. Argyle sent word to Powhatan that he would return his beloved daughter only when the chief had returned to him the English prisoners he held. The arms and tools that the Indians had stolen, and also some corn. After some time, Powhatan sent part of the ransom and asked that they treat his daughter well. Argyle returned to Jamestown in April of 1613 with Pocahontas, and she eventually moved to a new settlement, Henrico, which was under the leadership of Sir Thomas Dale. It was here that she began her education in the Christian faith. It's here they begin to teach her the word. And that she met a successful tobacco planter named John Ralph in 1613, July of that year. We spoke at some length of John Ralph. Listeners may remember, Rolfe's tobacco growing business became the first financial success of the New World and was central to the preservation of Virginia as a permanent colony. And they have a number of people in the midst of all of this. Rolfe is said to have been extraordinarily faithful in the Lord. And the idea that there are just a few that the around which the key events rotate is not uncommon as we look throughout history and see the handful or the one or the two that the Lord might use in a particular situation. And it's common to find this in history. Listeners may, Pocahontas was then allowed relative freedom within the settlement, and she began to enjoy her role in the relations between the colony and the people. After almost a year of captivity, Dale brought 150 armed men and Pocahontas into Powhatan's territory to obtain her entire ransom. He wanted the corn and the guns. Go figure. He was attacked by the Indians, and then the Englishmen burned many houses, destroyed villages, and killed several Indian men. Pocahontas was finally sent ashore, where she was reunited with two of her brothers, whom she told that she was treated well and that she was in love with the Englishman John Rolfe and wanted to marry him. Ultimately, and I mean after all of this, it seems a miracle in itself that her father would consent to this. After all of this, Powhatan gave his consent. And the Englishman departed, delighted at the prospect of a peacemaking marriage. They left even though they didn't get their corn and their guns. They thought this might actually be something of greater value. And again, John Rolfe was a very religious man, and he agonized over the decision to marry a strange wife, a heathen Indian. And he finally decided to marry Pocahontas when she was converted to Christianity, which of course had taken place over the period before this, for the good of the plantation, for the honor of our country. And these are quotes from Rolfe: for the good of the plantation, for the honor of our country, for the glory of God, for mine own salvation. Now, I don't know about anybody else. That sounds to me like John Rolfe felt a little funny about marrying this Native American heathen girl, and that the Lord quickened to him in a way that he could understand that this is something he better get with and get done. Now, I don't know how anybody else reads this, but as a Christian, when I see a guy in his own words testify that I am doing this thing for my own salvation, that says to me that the Lord has made it apparent to him that he better get with this program. And again, this is the essential role of just a few people in the early infant stages of colonization here in the Americas. Pocahontas was baptized and christened Rebecca, and then married John Rolfe on April 5th of 1614. A general peace and a spirit of goodwill between the English and the Indians resulted from this marriage. And the story isn't over yet, and we'll return to it after filling in the details of John Smith's testimony after his release by the natives in 1608. And we want to chronologically fill that bit of information in, and then we'll return here to finish the story of Pocahontas. Smith was escorted back to Jamestown on the 2nd of January of 1608, and Powhatan's people soon began to appear there regularly bringing food. Smith found the colony in a state of near chaos. The company had been reduced to fewer than 40 because of disease and starvation. This was the starving time Talked about it last week, mentioned it early in the broadcast. Ratcliffe charged Smith with responsibility for the deaths of his companions when he was captured, and the leaders of the colony were making preparations to abandon Jamestown. They're ready to run away. That evening, however, Christopher Newport returned from England with more than 100 men and ample supplies, and the general celebration that followed the leadership dropped the charges against Smith. The first supply, as it was known, brought more artisans to Virginia, including goldsmiths and refiners, as well as gunsmiths and a gunsmith and a blacksmith. The search for precious minerals was about to begin in earnest as soon as the new men were settled. They unloaded most of the supplies, then disaster struck when the whole place burned, including the supplies. Mere survival replaced mining as Newport's first objective, and Smith, because of his new association with Powhatan, became the key to survival. Smith soon arranged a meeting between Newport and Powhatan at Werowocomo. This is a tough one, folks. Werowocomoco. A lot of syllables in that town. And there, Powhatan reiterated the arrangement between himself and the English. Each side exchanged youths to learn each other's language and customs, and perhaps to serve as spies. You never know. Trading took place, and by being overly generous, Newport temporarily wrecked the rate of exchange. So many beads for so much corn that Smith had established. The meeting, however, ended amicably, and from Newport's viewpoint was a complete success. A food supply was guaranteed, and his men were now free to search for gold. They soon discovered what they thought was a gold mine upriver on the Pamunkey, and packed barrels with supposedly gold-laden earth. Newport sailed for England on April 10th to be disappointed when the so-called ore was analyzed there and deemed worthless. Listeners to last week's Jesus Factor will remember that this is what we now know as fool's gold, iron pyrite. I guess you needed a master chemist of this age to recognize that. And of course, when people are impassioned over money, which of course gold essentially was back then, all kinds of things can happen. And I think the reason they call it fool's gold is because people made a fool of themselves, nearly killing themselves, getting it, going after it, and seeking to ship it back to England. In a May 1609 voyage to Virginia, Sir Thomas Smith, Virginia Company treasurer, arranged for about 500 colonists, including women and children, to come along. A fleet of 9 ships set sail. The Sea Venture, with the flotilla admiral on board, wrecked on the Bermuda Islands. 1 year later, in May of 1610, after building boats to take all the passengers and crew of the Sea Venture off Bermuda, they finally made their way to Jamestown with the new governor, Thomas Gates. In August of 1609, John Smith was quite surprised to see the more than 300 new settlers arrive. And the arrival did not go well for him. London was sending settlers there with no planning or logistical support or organization. It was also recorded that John Smith was severely injured by an accidental gunpowder explosion in his canoe. We spoke of this last week, which decided his fate for him. He sailed to England for treatment in October of 1609. He spent 2.5 years trying to do his best for Jamestown. He never returned to Virginia. And history has confirmed his outstanding contribution to the English effort at Jamestown in its earliest years. In 1614, Smith returned to the Americas in a voyage to the coast of Maine and Massachusetts Bay. He named the region New England. He made 2 attempts in 1614 and 15 to return to the same coast. On the first trip, a storm demasted his ship. In the second attempt, he was captured by French pirates off the coast of the Azores. Smith escaped after weeks of captivity and made his way back to England, where he published an account of his 2 voyages, a description of New England. He never left England again, and he died in the year 1631 in London at age 51. The Captain John Smith Monument currently lies in disrepair off the coast of New Hampshire on Star Island, part of the Isle of Shoals, built in 1864 to commemorate the 250th anniversary of John Smith's visit to what he named Smith's Isles. The original monument was a tall pillar set on a triangular base atop a series of steps surrounded by granite supports and a sturdy iron railing. At the top of the original obelisk, there were three carved faces representing the several severed heads of the three Turks that Smith lopped off while in combat during his stint as a soldier in Transylvania. Remember, we spoke of that earlier. Now, we left Pocahontas' testimony shortly after her conversion to Christ and marriage to the first successful businessman in the New World, tobacco farmer and merchant John Rolfe. Sir Thomas Dale made an important voyage back to London in spring of 1616. His purpose was to seek further financial support for the Virginia Company and to ensure spectacular publicity. He brought with him about a dozen Algonquin Indians, including Pocahontas. Her husband and her young son Thomas accompanied her. The arrival of Pocahontas in London was well publicized. She was presented to King James I, the royal family, and the rest of the best of London society. Also in London at this time was Captain John Smith, the old friend she had not seen for 8 years and whom she believed was dead. According to Smith, at their meeting, she was at first too overcome with emotion to speak. After composing herself, Pocahontas talked of old times. At one point, she addressed him as father, and when he objected, she defiantly replied, "Were you not afraid to come into my father's country and caused fear in him and all of his people, and fear you here should I call you father? I tell you I will, and you shall call me child, and so will I be forever and ever, not just for a while, forever and ever, your countryman." Our read of that here on the Jesus Factor is that this had more to do with her being a Christian than any worldly kinship she felt for Smith. She saw Smith as her messenger in Christ, and most importantly, the fellowship as countrymen they experienced was a spiritual rather than a carnal nature, though both things were true in context. This was their last meeting. After 7 months, Rolfe decided to return his family to Virginia. In March of 1617, they set sail. It was soon apparent, however, that Pocahontas would not survive the voyage home. She was deathly ill from pneumonia, or possibly tuberculosis. She was taken ashore, and as she lay dying, she comforted her husband, saying, "All must die. 'Tis enough that the child liveth." She was buried in a churchyard in Gravesend, England. She was 22 years old. So that is the account of John Smith, his exploits, how they wound around the testimony of Pocahontas.